U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff smiled as he strolled through Red Square in Moscow yesterday. That was on his way in to talks between Russian and American officials over the war in Ukraine.
On the way out, it became clear the two sides did not break through to a peace agreement. They were working from a draft proposal amended by European and Ukrainian negotiators. Europeans had already rejected a plan skewed toward Russia.
We go now to NPR's Eleanor Beardsley, who's covering all this from Kyiv, Ukraine. Hey there, Eleanor.
Hello, Steve.
How was the meeting?
They lasted about 5 hours and started 3 hours late because they were waiting to meet President Vladimir Putin. And that's when Steve Witkoff and Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who was also in attendance, got their tour of Red Square. By the way, this is Witkoff's sixth visit to Moscow. He has not visited Ukraine. The talks broke up late last night with nothing concrete. Both sides called them constructive and productive. And this morning, the Kremlin says it's ready to sit down with the Americans as many times as necessary. Actually, the most telling comment came from President Putin himself, speaking separately to the media before the talks concluded. Let's listen. He accuses the Europeans of thwarting President Trump's attempts to bring peace in Ukraine. He says they amended the document knowing it would be unacceptable to Russia just so they could block the process and blame it on Moscow. Putin also made veiled threats to Europe, saying Russia didn't want war with Europe, but it was ready if Europe brought it on. And he said such a war wouldn't be, quote, like the surgical one that Russia's conducting in Ukraine. Well, yeah, European news outlets went wild over that comment. It was the main topic on primetime news.
Well, what are the Ukrainians saying?
Well, yesterday, President Volodymyr Zelensky spoke from Ireland. He's been bathing in European support over the last few days. He was in Paris before that. Zelensky has agreed in principle to this amended document. He didn't comment on the negotiations, but said Europe must keep the pressure on Russia. Here he is.
So that Russia does not believe it will be rewarded for this war with stolen Ukrainian land or thousands kidnapped Ukrainian children.
So, Steve, that's a far cry from the big business deals with Russia that President Trump has been talking about.
Where does this actually leave the effort for peace, Eleanor?
Well, Ukrainians never thought Putin would ever sign any deal. They say he doesn't want peace. He continues to bomb Ukraine and kill civilians on a near-nightly basis. And I spoke with Mykhailo Samus, director of a geopolitical research network in Ukraine. He says not only will Putin never stop, but Ukraine will never give away territory in the eastern Donbass region that the Russians are demanding. He says there is no possibility of a long-term peace document. Here he is.
All of these negotiations only about ceasefire on the front line. No withdrawing forces from Donbass, no recognizing that the Russian occupying forces will be legal on Ukrainian territory. Of course not.
I'd like to find out here, Eleanor, if there's a mistaken assumption. The president of the United States has assumed that Russia wants to stop the killing. He wants to. Obviously, they must. That leaked phone conversation by Bloomberg with Steve Witkoff contains in it an assumption that Russia wants to end this and the deal is obvious. That's the U.S. assumption. Has Russia shown it actually sees it that way?
No, Putin, the dying doesn't affect him. In fact, Zelensky and analysts confirmed this, that in the month of October alone, 25,000 Russian soldiers died in Ukraine. That doesn't affect Putin. They hide it from the Russian public anyway. I think Secretary of State Marco Rubio's comments yesterday from Washington are the most telling. Rubio said the conflict in Ukraine is not our war, and President Trump has a million other things to focus on. So there you go.
And NPR's Eleanor Beardsley, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Steve.
The Trump administration continues to face questions about a U.S. attack on an alleged drug boat in September in the Caribbean.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth told reporters at the White House on Tuesday he did not witness the second round of strikes that killed survivors on the boat.
I watched that first strike live. As you can imagine, at the Department of War, we got a lot of things to do. So I didn't stick around for the hour and 2 hours, whatever, where all the sensitive site exploitation digitally occurs. So I moved on to my next meeting.
Lawmakers now say they want to look into what happened.
NPR congressional correspondent Deirdre Walsh is with us. So we just heard Hegseth say that he had a lot on schedule the day of that strike. What other details did he talk about Tuesday?
He said he gave the initial order to strike the boat and then said he learned the details about the second strike a couple of hours later and said it was a decision made by Admiral Frank Bradley, who leads U.S. Special Operations Command. While Hegseth stressed he personally didn't make the call for a follow-on strike, he said Bradley had the complete authority to do so.
And by the way, Admiral Bradley made the correct decision to ultimately sink the boat and eliminate the threat.
You know, it's worth noting that Hegseth's comments yesterday are different from his initial response when the Washington Post first reported on these strikes and he criticized their reporting. Now he's acknowledging there was the second strike. President Trump, for his part, said he knew the military took out the boat, but he didn't know whether it was one strike or two or three, and he wasn't involved in it.
All right. So what are top Republicans on Capitol Hill saying about the attack?
Both House Speaker Mike Johnson and Senate Majority Leader John Thune say they back the move by House and Senate Armed Services Committees to review the boat strikes and expect to get answers. The Speaker said he wouldn't prejudge anything before they get the facts. Committees are expected to seek video and audio of the operation. Questions on the Hill really center around whether the second strike broke U.S. law or would be considered a war crime if the administration's claim to be at war with narco traffickers is accepted. And members of both parties want to review evidence and this timeline. Majority Leader Thune said he backed current U.S. policy, saying he agreed the administration had the authority for these attacks in the Caribbean. But when Thune was asked directly about whether he has confidence in Hegseth, he sidestepped the question.
Well, I think that the fundamental question is the country safer than it was under the Biden administration? I think the answer to that is unequivocally yes.
Thune said the Trump administration's peace through strength policies are working, and Hegseth is part of the team that put those in place. But he also added that Hegseth, quote, serves at the pleasure of the president, not exactly an endorsement of the secretary.
All right, so it seems like both GOP leaders of the House and Senate want at least some answers. Any word on how they'll try to get them?
You know, we haven't seen a lot of oversight from Republican committee chairmen in the first year of the Trump administration. But I will say on this issue, both chairs in the House and Senate came out really quickly and vowed vigorous oversight of these boat strikes. It's unclear if they're going to have public hearings or classified sessions. Admiral Bradley's in town and is expected to brief lawmakers later this week. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer wants Hegseth to release the video of the attack, and he's demanding that he testify publicly.
All right, that's NPR congressional correspondent Deirdre Walsh. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
Okay, Republican Matt Van Epps has won a special election for a U.S. House seat in Tennessee. That means the Republican edge in the House of Representatives doesn't get any narrower. But Democrats are also claiming victory after Tuesday night's results.
That's because last year, President Trump won Tennessee's 7th congressional district by about 22 percentage points. Yesterday, Van Epps won by 9. Both parties spent millions of dollars in the final weeks of this race to try and test their campaign message ahead of the 2026 midterms.
NPR's Stephen Fowler has been following the campaign. Stephen, good morning.
Good morning.
Why did this race receive so much attention?
Well, it's math. Republicans have a narrow House majority and fractious coalitions. This gives them one more vote until Georgia Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene resigns in a few weeks. Here's more math. In 60 state legislative and congressional special elections this year, Democrats have improved from their 2024 margins by an average of 13%. Those elections were typically low turnout, low profile contests where Democrats were more likely to vote. So given Trump's margins in this Tennessee district, super PACs from both parties poured more than $6.5 million in recent weeks into making this a high-turnout, high-profile contest where Democrats still ended up improving their margins by 13%.
Oh, really interesting result then. And it seems that Democrats turned out a lot of voters. Who's right in declaring victory then?
Well, the final margin of the race means both parties can, with a straight face, declare a victory moving forward. That's because Republicans motivated their base without Trump being on the ballot. Van Epps said in victory remarks that, quote, running from Trump is how you lose, running with Trump is how you win. But he actually didn't campaign much using the president's name or accomplishments. And Democrats are putting 2024's losses behind them and have also motivated their base, who's been pretty sour on the party as a whole. And they seem to also have persuaded independents that Republican governance won't solve key issues.
So in last month's elections, we heard a lot about affordability. I'm thinking about that as a political slogan, six syllables, lots of syllables. But anyway, the economy is what that was about. How did it factor in?
Well, Steve, one candidate decried career politicians and promised to bring down prices, create good-paying jobs, and lower healthcare costs for working families. The other candidate promised to shake up Washington by making healthcare more affordable, bringing down the cost of living, and protect workers and small businesses. If you're wondering which one was the Republican and which was the Democrat, you're not alone. It was pretty hard to tell them apart on this issue, which was also notable for the candidate's lack of talking about Trump.
Oh, this is really interesting. The Democrat maybe didn't talk about Trump so much because she wanted the votes of former Trump voters, and the Republican didn't talk about Trump so much because he's not so popular at this moment. But with all of this said, I mean, we're reading all of this to look at 2026 and trying to find how we can forecast the future. Is there anything about Tuesday's result that truly matters when thinking about the midterms where things will be different?
Well, clearly the economy is top of mind. Republicans are figuring out how to address those concerns about costs without explicitly crossing Trump, and Democrats are also workshopping ways to win back key parts of their coalition. Looking at the election results, the drop-off in turnout in deep blue areas that we saw last year is nowhere to be found, and the rightward leap of young voters and non-white voters has snapped back towards Democrats. In a midterm year, the dynamics typically see the party out of power do well, so this is another data point in favor of that trend continuing.
NPR's Stephen Fowler, thanks so much.
Thank you.